From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we hear from a woman who was detained while protesting the decision not to charge a Wauwatosa police officer for his third on-duty death. Then we compare the COVID-19 pandemic to some of the other pandemics from modern history.
You know, with a broader lens of history, we can look back and see, well, it seems like a long time while we're in the middle of this sort of thing. This will eventually wind down, it will end, but we also need to be aware there'll be another pandemic.
Plus, we learn about one of the most infamous American con men you've probably never heard of, James Strang.
The fact that Strang was a man who understood what was going on around him and understood how it might fit his personal needs led to his ascension in the minds of hundreds of people to King of Earth and Heaven.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Milwaukee County District's attorney's decision not to charge Wauwatosa police officer Joseph Menza for the shooting death of 17-year-old Alvin Cole has led to several nights of protest. The shooting of Cole was Menza's third on-duty death in 5 years, and no charges were filed in any of the cases. Ahead of the decision, Wauwatosa Mayor Dennis McBride approved an emergency order for a curfew that lasted several nights. City buildings were closed, and Wauwatosa schools went virtual. The National Guard was also called in to help law enforcement and prevent property damage. But the curfew did not keep people from protesting, and as we've seen all summer, they clashed with police. Police used pepper balls to disperse crowds, and Wauwatosa Police Chief Barry Weber says about 65 people were arrested over 5 nights of protests for curfew and other violations. Molly Nelson was picked up Saturday. She says she's been protesting this summer, including following the Menza decision. Nelson told WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell what happened the night she was detained.
We joined together with Wauwatosa residents on City Hall. Curfew was 7 o'clock. A lot of people started to head out. Our group, shortly after curfew was invoked, we headed to the sidewalk, heading east out of North Avenue, out of Wauwatosa. So a lot of the media was there, and I was just literally filming what was going on. And as I was filming, I did not choose to get arrested, obviously, but I knew I was taking a risk. My group on the sidewalk marched out. This was before 8 o'clock at night. The only violation that anyone even remotely did was curfew, and they were leaving. I chose to stay and continue to film, so it was literally, you can see it in my video, me on a sidewalk. A little bit of media was left. They ended up leaving. I was literally the only human being, like no protesters, nobody. And they brought more people out. They started pushing the tanks forward. They did not retreat. They did not try to, you know, they could have had one squad car come up. They could have gone home. And one squad car could have said, hey, lady, you're nuts. Go home. It's curfew. That's enough. And I would have, you know, I mean, I have no intention. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I'm an old lady. I'm not trying to like be this like crazy wild, you know, I'm not trying to tear anything up. I was just trying to show the truth. So I stood on the sidewalk, and filmed them, and you can hear they gave me a curfew warning. And I, as I said in my video, a curfew is a citation. That's it. Well, as I was backing away and I finally was like, all right, this is enough. I started walking down North Avenue, and I was surrounded by 10 officers. This is also on Channel 4. They got footage of it. I was surrounded by 10 officers. I was cuffed. I was taken not in the car that they pulled up in. I was taken down the street around the corner, past the line of tanks and officers and National Guard and all that. I was taken to an unmarked van, no windows, cuffed. My wrists are bruised and sore right now. That's the worst of it, though. I mean, I'm very lucky. I know I'm privileged, and I know I got very lucky. I got put into the back of a van with two other women. who are Tulsa residents, just people exercising their rights, who have been cuffed and put into a van, driven around. We had no clue where we were going. They strap you in, cuffed. I had no weapon, no threat. I was nothing. I'm just a person trying to say that Black Lives Matter. I was taken around. I don't. The next layer of how messed up this is. So I'm a teacher in Milwaukee. The amount of money being spent on this year, when we don't have funding for our schools, for our healthcare, for all the things we need. But then they took us in this van to a school parking lot, a school. Why are they doing this on school grounds where our babies go to school? And they had their weapons on them on school property, but apparently the law doesn't stand for them. And they transferred us to another van. And then they said the seatbelt didn't work, so they took one of the women I was with into a van by herself, split us up. We had no clue where we were going. I don't know which school I was at. I just saw a playground. I know it was a school. We were in the back of it. I don't know where we were. Then they drove us to a station. They wouldn't tell us what station we were in. My parents were calling and calling. They wouldn't say that I was there. I didn't even tell them where I was. I was never arrested. I mean, I wasn't even locked up. They took us in the holding room and just processed it, and all we got was a $1,300 citation, a citation for curfew. I will also say at the end of it, after everything was released, I had everything back. I don't know. They gave me my phone back. They haven't done that to everyone, which is also terrifying. They said, you need to go get back in the van. We're going to take you. We're going to drop you off. And I said, absolutely not. Why would you need to drop me off? I'm super claustrophobic. I said, I'm not getting back in that van. I couldn't breathe. And they said, well, we need to drop you off back by Wauwatosa East. And I said, why would I go to Wauwatosa East? I don't have a car there. I have nothing there. I have no one there. And the other officer said, no, we're going to take you to your house. He said, you live in Wauwatosa, right? I said, my address is right there. You know I don't live in Wauwatosa. They said, well, we have to get you in the van. We have to take you. I said, no, I'm not being detained right now. You have to let me go. Well, we don't want a crowd outside the station. We don't want your people coming to pick you up. We don't want a crowd. And we don't want you to get a curfew citation. I said, you already gave me the curfew citation. And if you drop me off at Tulsa East, I'm still violating curfew. So how is that helpful? Mm-hmm. And they argued and argued and argued. And finally, they took me out back. I still didn't know what station I was at. Took me out back and let me go, and then told me I was on 117th off, you know, at the Wauwatosa police station. So they've been doing that. They've been dropping our people off on random locations with no phone. They've just been taking them back out into the city. Some of our people ended up on Locust, on the east side. Like, it's really concerning what they're doing. I mean, it's like bad, really bad.
And so was this Wauwatosa police, or could you tell it was a different agency? Oh.
A few agencies were there. I saw Brookfield, but this was Wauwatosa police.
Okay.
So during a press conference with Mayor McBride and Chief Weber, they were asked about people being dropped off in random areas of the city, not being given back their phones. And Chief Weber had said that that wasn't true. What do you think about that?
It's a lie. If anything, that just goes to show to a deeper rooted issue of just a break of democracy. I mean, there was no legal reason for them to take any of us. Breaking a curfew is not an arrest. It's not a handcuffs. It's not a back of a van. These vans weren't even police marked. I mean, they were literally unmarked plain vans. You would have no way to know where you were going, who was taking you. The fact that they're lying blatantly, boldly, I have absolutely no proof. That's what scares me the most. I have my story, and a lot of people have their story, but what could stop them from lying? What is the evidence? Oh, up until the moment my camera went off when I got arrested, what evidence do I have? And that's what scares me, is that, you know, I am in a position to talk, but a lot of people don't have that that luxury or that freedom to do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I don't know how else you get the truth out other than to talk, you know.
And since you've mentioned like just the amount of, you know, police force that's out there, Mayor McBride is saying, you know, they wanted to be prepared so that this wasn't, you know, following the decision, that this wasn't, you know, another Kenosha. He's like, there is a reason you're seeing all these forces, but you're like, that is not really necessary.
Not even close to necessary. There's absolutely, I mean, first of all, as citizens of this country, you have a right to speak your mind, and to see that you are met with, I mean, literally, I say tear gas. Again, I have a video of that too. Like, so the we've been tear gassed over the last couple months, but the stuff they were using was like, people were, I mean, they were using like some high grade, like potent stuff. And that was because we were in the street. That's because we were standing in a street. It's very concerning.
With how the public, you know, has clashed with police, and we're talking specifically in Tulsa, do you think there is a way for, you know, trust to be built? Is there a way for Tulsa to come out of this moment?
So I want to be clear that I am speaking as an individual right now, not for my group. I don't want to any boundaries with that.
Of course.
I'm also a white voice, which I don't necessarily feel comfortable speaking as a white voice, but I also think that I stayed behind risking it because I knew that I want the truth to come out, and if I can assist in that, I will speak. But I'm only speaking from my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
But we have some very strong allies in Wauwatosa, some groups that are working with us. We have a lot of residents who are seeing this. We have businesses who are stepping up in different ways. I think the hope would be that there has to be accountability. And in that, I mean, people need to be filming. People need to be reporting. People need to be speaking up. We need to look at next steps. I can't think that all hope is lost, because otherwise I wouldn't still be out there every day. But I think the forces that be need to really, really take a look at what's happening. And I mean, on a national level, I mean, we are the only place that has an officer with 3 bodies on his record, and it's not about him. They're pawns. These officers are pawns. It's about the higher level. And it needs to be addressed that this is a corrupt, very deeply corrupt system that we're working with right now. And unless it gets taken, you know, very seriously by powers outside of where we are right now, I mean, this has to be looked at. Police can't police the police because they don't. We need to take this seriously. Milwaukee spends more money in Wauwatosa than Wauwatosa themselves. And yet our black and brown people are literally abused daily. You can't find one person that hasn't had a story of being abused in Wauwatosa by the police. I mean, it's serious. It's a civil rights issue.
Molly Nelson was taken into police custody while protesting in Wauwatosa. She shared her experience with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. Coming up, we'll look at the history of modern pandemics, how they've shaped our understanding of how to deal with them, and how to better prepare for the next one. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The coronavirus pandemic has transformed the way we live, but it's not the first time this has happened in our culture. Throughout our history, pandemics have had an enormous impact on society and how we're able to live. And although many have drawn parallels to the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, there have been other, more recent pandemics that left their mark on our world. Anne Dressel is the director of the Center for Global Health Equity, and she's one of the presenters in an upcoming webinar all about understanding pandemics. She joins Lake Fexjoy Powers to talk about this history and what it can tell us about the present.
One of the things that has been interesting about this time period that we're living in is I think we've all had to adopt a kind of new lexicon. And something that people use pretty interchangeably are a number of terms that refer to this kind of disease, this mass disease. So what is the difference between a pandemic, an epidemic, something that is endemic, and, you know, a plague?
Oh, that's a really good question, because those terms have been coming up a lot recently. And it's important that people have a good understanding of what they mean. So for example, an epidemic, that's an occurrence of disease that pops up temporarily at a really high prevalence, meaning a lot of people get it, but it's confined to just one part of the world or a single country. A pandemic is an epidemic that happens worldwide. So it's this, you know, flare up of a infectious disease that's affecting people across a very wide area. So a pandemic is something that arises from an epidemic. And the difference between the two usually has to do with scale. Another term we'll hear of is something called endemic, some sort of infectious agent that's just always there in a certain geographic area. So for example, malaria is endemic in certain parts of the world. My colleagues and I do a lot of work in Malawi and Kenya, and malaria is endemic there. It's just always present. And then the plague is something that I'm sure a lot of people have heard about and comes up a lot. We all have heard of the Black Death in the 14th century, and that was caused by the plague. And that's a very specific type of infectious disease caused by a certain bacteria that's found in small mammals, and then it's spread by their fleas. So it's a zoonotic disease. That means it's a disease that's spread from animals to humans. And in the case of the plague, it was spread through flea bites. So the fleas would, you know, bite these infected animals, and then they'd bite humans, and it would get spread that way. And that was one of the most serious pandemics that the world had experienced. It killed anywhere between 75 to 200 million people globally. And again, this is the middle of the 14th century, and killed 30 to 60% of Europe's population.
So a lot of people have focused on the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. But something that you bring up is there have actually been other pandemics in recent history.
Yes, definitely. Some of the ones that have happened within the past, like 50, 25 years and affected us here in the U.S., include the Asian flu pandemic of 1957 to 58. And that killed a little over a million people worldwide, but it also killed between 70,000 to 116,000 people here in the U.S. And like we're seeing today, it led to school closures. There were economic impacts. In fact, they found that the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 15% of its value in the second half of 1957. I think a lot of people have heard of the flu pandemic of 1968. That was something that was first reported in Hong Kong and was brought back here to the U.S. by troops returning from the Vietnam War, because it had spread throughout Southeast Asia. And that too killed between 1 and 4 million people worldwide. And it's not just flus that have caused pandemics. In the last century, we also had a global cholera pandemic in the early part of the 1900s, which actually killed some people here in the US. The last outbreak of cholera here in the US was part of that pandemic in 1910 and 1911. And like we're seeing today, there were quarantine measures put in place. And unfortunately, like we're seeing today, there's a lot of stigma attached to it and concerns about, you know, who's bringing these diseases and a lot of discrimination here in the U.S. against what people were terming outsiders who they felt might be bringing the disease.
That is a common thread, it seems like, in all of these kinds of pandemics. When we look back at, you know, these more recent experiences, What are some of the parallels that we see?
It's easy to draw some parallels, I think, between the current COVID-19 pandemic and the 1918 flu pandemic, as you had mentioned earlier. As of October 13th, the World Health Organization estimates we've had about 38 million cases of COVID-19, and we're coming on to a little over 1 million deaths. We're getting close to 1.1 million deaths globally. And just this month in October, the World Health Organization estimated about 10% of the world's population may have been affected with COVID. Here in the US, I think it's no surprise to anyone, we've got the highest number of cases in the world. We've got about 7.7 million cases as of October 12th, and we're getting close to 215,000 people who have died. COVID-19 is also a zoonotic disease, as we had mentioned earlier. It's something that scientists believe originated in an animal, in this case, bats, and was spread to humans. And the flu pandemic was also a zoonotic disease, although that one originated in birds. And that was very deadly. It was the deadliest pandemic in modern history. Scientists estimated that about 50 million people were killed globally and about 675,000 here in the US. And it had infected about one third of the world's population before it died down. But some other similarities, just both of these, the 1918 flu and COVID-19 were novel. They were new diseases. So they're something that people were not immune to. They're both airborne diseases. So they're spread through the air. So when we talk, when we sneeze, when we cough, there's respiratory droplets that are spreading that disease. And then, you know, other people inhale that and get infected. Or we can touch something that has the virus on it, and then touch our mouth, our nose, our eyes, somewhere, it's, you know, somehow that it gets into our system and infects us. Both of COVID-19 and the 1918 flu, there was no vaccine for them. But there were also political aspects to both of them. So for example, during the 1918 flu pandemic, there were concerns about lies and censorship and propaganda. And so it was really suppressed information about the flu at first because politicians wanted to keep morale up during World War I. And it's part of the reason why we sometimes hear it called the Spanish flu, because press coverage about it had been censored, again, to keep morale up, but newspapers were not being censored in Spain. So for example, the king of Spain had come down with the flu. So it got a lot of publicity, and that's one of the reasons it started being referred to as the Spanish flu. And we certainly see parallels today with information, propaganda, lies getting spread on social media about COVID-19, and also political pressure on what information is being released. Relatedly, there were concerns about ignoring the science during the pandemic of 1918. So scientists and healthcare professionals were advocating for containment measures to stop the spread of the 1918 flu. But again, partly due to the war effort, many of those suggestions were ignored. So troops were still being, you know, crowded into ships to get them where they needed to be in the world to help fight the war. There were also issues during the 1918 flu pandemic related to large public gatherings. So for example, there was something called Liberty Loan Parades that were very popular at the time. It was a way to raise support for war bonds to help support the war effort here in the United States. But many big cities ignored health officials' advice and held the parades, which were attended by thousands of people. So for example, Philadelphia had one of these Liberty Loan Parades in 1918, and an estimated 200,000 people attended. And 2 days later, every hospital bed in the city was filled. And again, we're seeing some of that today with large public gatherings, maybe they're political rallies or other events, but things that are happening that go against the advice of healthcare professionals. And that's also related to misplaced priorities. So in 1918, during the flu pandemic, there was a big priority on winning the war. And again, we can see parallels to today with priorities placed on, you know, what's going on with our national elections and people really wanting to win the election. So that comes back to some of these public gatherings that are happening. There were similar control measures in place, both during the 1918 flu pandemic and today, things like quarantining, social distancing, limiting public gatherings, advice about washing your hands and practicing good hygiene, but also mask mandates. And just like today in 1918 during the pandemic, there was a lot of resistance to wearing masks, even though science shows it can help to reduce the spread of disease. History has shown that cities that had strict mask wearing orders or had other protocols in place to help control this disease were less impacted. So they had fewer people who were infected and fewer people who were dying.
Yeah. You know, as you mentioned, of course, we've had a lot of political rallies here in the state of Wisconsin, many of which haven't really required you to wear a mask. There are certain parts of the state where people have been completely unmasked despite state orders. And we're seeing record highs here right now. When we look at how the United States has traditionally responded to these kinds of pandemics, specifically in the context of the rest of the world, where do we generally fit? Do we usually have this many more infected people than other places? Because it does feel atypical.
That's an interesting question. So here in the U.S., we do have excellent healthcare. We have excellent resources, good technology, you know, a lot of smart healthcare professionals. The issue here in the U.S., though, is not everybody has access to it. So the United States is the only high-income country in the world that does not have some sort of national or universal healthcare system that would, you know, ensure everyone has access to a certain level of healthcare. And as a result, our health outcomes are not as good as in other high-income countries. And we're seeing all of that exacerbated now during the COVID-19 pandemic. We're seeing that COVID-19 is disproportionately impacting, you know, our African-American communities, our Latino communities, and it's exacerbating those healthcare disparities that have existed, you know, for many, many years. So we have a lot of good things to offer here in the U.S., but not everyone in the U.S. has access to them. And the current pandemic is really highlighting those things. And I think one thing I would add related to all this that each of us can do is to vote for elected officials that support public health, because there's measures in place right now, you know, or bills that are on the floor at the federal level about getting the U.S. involved in a COVID-19 vaccine global access initiative. It's a global partnership that's focused on developing and then equitably distributing the vaccine worldwide. So if we were at the table, we could certainly contribute a lot to that and also gain a lot from that. Likewise, ask our elected officials to advocate that the United States remain in the World Health Organization and pay our dues. And many people think, you know, that the organization needs reform, but I think it's easier to help reform an organization from within than just to pull out of it. And likewise, we can advocate that our own federal agencies be fully funded, like the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, National Institutes of Health. And another area that the U.S. is behind on compared to other countries is we do not spend a lot of money on public health, whereas that could generate a lot of cost savings on the back end, because I think we all know the old adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So it's much cheaper to prevent people from getting sick in the first place than it is to try to treat them and cure them after the fact.
Yeah. Now, as we look at the general arc of pandemics, at least historically, is there a pattern and can that inform what we should expect in the coming months?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because there's been some discussion, for example, about how did the 1918 flu pandemic end? Part of it had to do with, you know, it was so widespread and affected so many people that it got harder and harder for the virus to find, you know, people who weren't already infected. So I know there's been discussion in the media lately about herd immunity, so meaning enough people will have had COVID-19 that'll protect all of us. But we've got a long ways to go to get there. you know, eventually this is going to be running its course through the population, or hopefully very soon we'll have a vaccine that people will be protected. But there's also many of these traditional measures that we've known about for over a century that would help. Things like wearing a mask, social distancing, you know, putting limits on public gatherings, quarantining, hand washing, closing schools, which has happened. We know these measures work, but it's really hard for us to follow them. But I think, you know, with a broader lens of history, we can look back and see, well, it seems like a long time while we're in the middle of this sort of thing. This will eventually wind down, it will end, but we also need to be aware there'll be another pandemic in the future. And so it's really important for the United States to be engaged with other partners on the global level so that we can be better positioned to hopefully prevent a future outbreak, but then also respond more quickly in the future so that fewer people are dying.
Yeah. Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Anne Dressel is the director of the Center for Global Health Equity at UW-Milwaukee, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. She's one of the presenters at a webinar through Freidert and the Medical College of Wisconsin called Inside a Pandemic. The event will be on October 23rd, and you can find more information at wuwm.com. We'll take one last break and then find out more about the Mormon king and con man you've never heard of, James Strang. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Teacher, lawyer, editor, prophet, pirate, state legislator, historian, and king of earth and heaven. Believe it or not, these titles all belong to one man, James Strang. In 1843, young lawyer and avowed atheist Strang fled rural New York and reappeared in what is now Burlington, Wisconsin. While in the Midwest, he converted to a new religious movement called Mormonism. Following the murder of church founder Joseph Smith, Strang claimed that the prophet named him successor. During antebellum America, Strang managed to convince his followers to move to Beaver Island in northernmost Lake Michigan to create a pirate colony where polygamy, theft, corruption, and many frauds were practiced. The story of how an atheist managed to become a self-proclaimed divine king until his assassination in 1856 is fascinating, and Miles Harvey wrote all about it. Harvey's new book on James Strang is called The King of Confidence. He joins me now to share more about this infamous con man.
Well, it's one of the great reinvention stories of the 19th century, which was absolutely full of such stories. So Strang grew up a farm boy in Western New York. It was a hugely religious place at that time. It was called the Burned Over District because there were so many religious and political and cultural fires burning there. But he was an atheist, but his journals are available from his time he was about 17 or 18 to a time he was in his early 20s. And he in code writes that he's a secret atheist, but he also writes about how when he talks about religion, people really get excited. Well, in any case, he was a failure in everything he did there, and he got out of town under suspicious circumstances, kind of flew by night, and showed up eventually in Burlington, visited Nauvoo, which was then the center of Mormon religion and culture, a town on the Mississippi in Illinois, and converted to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And in 1844, Joseph Smith, the founder of that church, was murdered by a mob. And shortly thereafter, Strang claimed that Smith had handed over the entire church to him.
Yeah, through this letter, you know, that many people have scrutinized over, and he also produced these bronze plates to convince people that here's another story that was just for me that only I can translate. And you mentioned, you know, people get fired up when they heard him talk about religion and such. What was it about this period in time? We're talking mid-1800s, 1840s onwards, about antebellum America that made it ripe for Strang to capture people and ascend into a religion he, you know, in all accounts was very new to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain periods in history when the truth becomes malleable. And in the case of antebellum America, which was, of course, the years before the Civil War, there was just incredible societal tremors, a communications revolution, a depression that was the worst thing America had ever encountered, incredible changes in technology, you know, the camera, the telegraph, the railways. America is just suddenly a different place. There's great demographic dislocation. Suddenly it's a nation of strangers. And at times like this, someone like Strang, who makes his own truth and has great confidence in preaching his truth to other people, tend to thrive. There's a reason this period gave birth to the word confidence man. We know exactly when that word started in 1849. And we know exactly how quickly it spread throughout the culture because there were so many of these people. It's also the period where P.T. Barnum, the great hoaxer, public hoaxer, was prominent and, in fact, a superstar. And so I think the fact that Strang was a man who understood what was going on around him and understood how it might fit his personal needs led to his ascension in the minds of hundreds of people to King of Earth and Heaven.
Before we get to his colony in Wisconsin, I want to talk about what Strang, you know, how he differed from other Mormons. So what did Strang preach and practice in Mormonism that was different from the larger sect that was currently being formed and led by Brigham Young? This is right before they're heading out to Utah, basically.
So Strang had one big difference with Young at the beginning, which was that he was opposed to polygamy. And he said, I'll never change on this. This is my diehard principle. But it's sort of like Lindsey Graham's diehard principle about Supreme Court nominations. It quickly changed once he picked up a following. Many people came to him because he opposed polygamy. But he ended up dying with five wives, four of them pregnant at the time of his death in 1856. But I think more than anything else, he offered people a sense that he was a prophet of God. You know, Young initially sort of billed himself as an efficient technocrat who could take over the church for Young. And this might have been a mistake on Brigham Young's part. The other thing that Strang had really going for him was location. When the Mormons were kicked out of Nauvoo by mobs with the cooperation of the government and forced to move west, they were going into completely unknown territory. And Strang was just a few hundred miles away in a nice prairie town in Wisconsin. And he said to a lot of Mormons who were really worried about their personal safety and that of their family, why don't you just move up here?
The colony you're talking about is called Voree, and this is right in Burlington today, what is known as Burlington. So what made the Burlington area ideal to settle and make Voree, and what did it turn to that made Strang need to relocate to Beaver Island in Lake Michigan?
Well, I mean, Voree. Burlington is a beautiful, beautiful place. And it's right, the listeners who know southern Wisconsin know that it's right where the White and Fox Rivers come together. I mean, I suppose it was an okay place for a colony anyway, but the advantage to Strang was that he was living there. He had moved there. And some people who knew him at the time think his whole attempt at becoming a prophet of God was an attempt to just pull off a real estate scam in Voree, where he and his friends owed a lot of property. So that was one thing. I think actually Burlington proved to be a very bad place for him in certain ways because it was porous, right? His followers could leave and many of them did. They got out there, they were really impoverished there. And the better you got to know Strang sometimes, the more he came off as less than a prophet. But his opponents stayed. He lured some real bigwigs from the Mormon Church to come to Burlington, and some of them quickly turned against him and announced that he was a fraud. And so I think he just needed someplace where he could have more control. And so eventually he and some of the sort of con men around him eyed Beaver Island, which is in the northernmost reaches of Lake Michigan.
So how did you find accounts of what life was like on Beaver Island? You know, there's a lot of circumstances or events throughout this book that are speculative by nature, but also the nature of the story is so unique that I feel like as a reader, I couldn't completely dismiss or discount anything. So how were you able to find bits and pieces?
Well, there's a lot of documentary evidence. Yale University has a huge collection. Strang ran a newspaper in which he spoke, through which he spoke all the time. He was a little bit like President Trump with Twitter. He was anxious to communicate his views, anxious to pick fights with other people. So some of the critical newspaper stories about Strang, we know about because he republished them in full in his own newspapers. But there were also really good accounts by people who lived there, including about sort of domestic life there. And finally, I lucked out in that there's been a revolution in the past, say, 10 years of digitizing 19th century newspapers. And so I was really able to get some information that other researchers just couldn't have had access to a few years ago. And so I think I was really able in The King of Confidence to expand our knowledge of Strang, both his good works and his bad.
So you mentioned he kept up a newspaper, wrote articles, and his diary was only up until his early 20s. So do you see a difference in the words you read from his diary versus what he was controlling and putting out to his people in the newspaper? You know, did you ever get a true sense of who he was?
Well, I mean, so the 19th century and the antebellum period in particular was this, you know, this great age of the self-made man, right? We think about all sorts of self-made men from this period, including Lincoln, who Strang had many things in common with. And so Strang was just a brilliant self-inventor. And so what you see in his diaries is a guy who says, I want to be king. He says at one point in the diaries, you know, if only I had the chance, I would marry Princess Victoria, later Queen Victoria of England, and I would be a great king. And so in some ways, these crazy ideas of a farm boy in Western New York were really self-actualized. I mean, he became a lawyer. He became, you know, a legislator in the Michigan State Legislature, in the Michigan House. He did an amazing amount of stuff, and it's all stuff he dreamed about as a young man. So in some ways, there's a real consistency between the crazy notions he has in his diary and the crazy realities he brought about in his life.
There's a quote in the book that says, someone observing Strang, quote, he does not seem to be conscious that all his professions of piety and religion are utterly negatived by his conduct.
Yeah. And actually, if I could just correct you a little bit, that quote's about P.T. Barnum in a chapter where I'm writing about Strang and his attempts to formalize himself to a broad public in the way Barnum did with his autobiography. Yeah, but I thought, I used that quote because I thought it applied to Strang too. I think that he probably believed that what he was doing was in some way righteous just because he was doing it. So, you know, people ask me all the time, do you think he actually thought of himself as a prophet of God? And I think it's a really hard question.
The Mormons on Beaver Island are really characterized as pirates that terrorize other people on the island, people within boating reach, you know, going to Wisconsin and Michigan to just steal supplies, thinking that we can steal from people who aren't Mormons because it's our rights. And, you know, it really dampers the idea of they're living in some sort of utopia. And do you think these ideas of utopias, especially in antebellum period, can be attributed more towards a want or need to escape versus a true desire for man to live in a better society?
Well, I think the utopian impulse, which was widespread at this time in the United States, has really complex roots. I mean, I think in some ways it's just a reaction to brutal realities of capitalism at the time. But I also think that people really hoped and dreamed of something better. I mean, Strang's followers thought that they were bringing about the second coming of Christ on Beaver Island in Lake Michigan. Now, that may sound absurd to us now, but it was not absurd to them then. And I think that explains, among the true believers on his colony, why they might engage in theft. In other words, you know, I don't have time to worry about your Wisconsin state laws right now. I got to bring about the second coming of Christ. And so we need these materials. We need this food. We need these supplies. We're just going to take them. It was something that was sometimes justified in Mormon culture at that time, and especially on Strang's colony, as what's called consecration. So there was that. But he also surrounded himself with some very cynical con men types. And even among them, there was a certain kind of righteousness and weirdness that was just wonderful. One of them was a guy named George J. Adams, who went around the country performing Shakespeare on one night and preaching for Strang on the other. And he was kind of a famous guy at this period, just full of bombast, outrageous drunk, a man with supposedly terrible body odor, but also someone who could really bring in the followers, who convinced a lot of people to join Strang's sect. And before that, had toured England and brought many, many recruits to the American wilderness at Nauvoo. So, yeah, I think the utopian impulse is just so complex at this time. And many good things came out of it and many bad things came out of it.
Strang, you know, our listeners so far will hear that he self-actualized a lot of the things he set out to do, but he also was a target of the federal government. You know, he had the attention of the president, faced federal trial. Lots of things were, you know, tried to bring him down, and ultimately he was assassinated by a couple of previous followers. And I'm wondering, do modern-day Mormons have an official stance on James Strang and this unique sect of Mormonism?
Yeah, I think they had the same stance. I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on Mormon theology or Mormon culture, and I would never presume to pass myself off as anything but someone who's interested and who knows a little bit about this offshoot story. But you know, Strang was kicked out of the church at the time. So it wasn't like he was accepted by the Brighamite Mormons. On the other hand, he presented a real challenge to Brigham Young. I mean, there was a period in 1853, which was well into Strang's kingdom and well into, you know, the history of Salt Lake City, where even one of Young's top officials took seriously the possibility that Strang might be appointed governor of Utah, which would have been a real mess for Brigham Young. So Strang had sort of extraordinary power over people who should have had power over him. You mentioned just quickly that a U.S. president went after him. It's very true. We laugh about Strang now sometimes, but Millard Fillmore took his threat of an independent kingdom on U.S. soil seriously enough that he invaded the island with the Navy's first iron-hulled warship and dragged Strang back to trial in Detroit. Strang won. He was acquitted. His people were acquitted. And when Millard Fillmore, the U.S. president, left office in 1853, kind of in disrepute, Strang was still king.
What stuck with you the most after, you know, all this time of working on this book and all the primary research combing through this? You know, was there maybe a particular event or little tidbit you read, or even just a realization of this man you came to know?
Well, I think, you know, as a writer, whether you're a fiction writer or a nonfiction writer, you yearn for three-dimensional people to write about. And Strang was that. You know, I think with the King of Confidence, I've sort of pushed our understanding of him as a criminal and the leader of a criminal enterprise. You know, other writers had said there's not absolute proof he did any of this, despite multiple and widespread newspaper stories about it. But I've sort of put him on the scene of a crime and sort of pin down other aspects of his followers going to jail in a way that probably hadn't been done, well, hadn't been done before. But I also think I've kind of expanded like a fascinating side of him, which is his belief in the abolition movement. I think it's the one true thing that Strang believed in. And it's the one thing that he pursued that was not in his self-interest. So when he was in the Michigan House, he voted against his own party, the Democrats, for legislation, for instance, that would undercut the Fugitive Slave Act, which was a hugely controversial piece of legislation which allowed Southern slave hunters to come into the North after slaves. And I think I've sort of pinned down through some research why Strang believed in abolitionism and why this was the one true thing he embraced. And so that was what sticks with me, is just Strang as a fascinating figure, full of good and evil and over serious self-belief, but also a sense of humor sometimes. I just found him amazing to think about for 5 years, and I'll miss him.
Well, yeah, fascinating man, certainly made for a fascinating book and read. So, Miles Harvey, thanks so much for talking to me about it today.
Oh, thank you, Audrey. I really appreciate it.
Miles Harvey is the author of The King of Confidence, a tale of utopian dreamers, frontier schemers, true believers, false prophets, and the murder of an American monarch. He'll talk more about it in a virtual event this evening for the Wisconsin Book Festival. You can find more information at wuwm.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.